Okay, folks, so I mentioned on a recent stream that earlier this year I gave a speech to a number of fairly important people in the so-called intellectual dark web at Oxford, and some people wanted me to share this with them. Now, it was recorded, but I never saw that recording make it onto any onto YouTube or anywhere else, as far as I know. So what I've done is I've basically recorded my own version, so you guys at least have access to this speech I gave. I've actually weirdly toned it down from the speech I gave on the day, which had all sorts of spiciness in it. Like, for example, at one moment I had a go at Owen Jones and stuff like that. I've taken some of that stuff out because I wanted to keep this under 20 minutes. So anyway, here it is. Hope you enjoy it. When I was a teenager, I read four works of literature that would have a lasting impact on me. The first was George Orwell's 1984, which I read in one sitting. Then, when it was finished, I started the whole thing again. I remember that it left me stunned for days on end. The second was Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange, which is ultimately a book about the importance of free will in moral decision-making. The third was Arthur Miller's The Crucible, a play about the Salem witch trials in which the protagonist is coerced to confess that he has consorted with the devil. The fourth was Harold Pinter's The Birthday Party, which ends with the immortal line, "Stan, don't let them tell you what to do." On reflection, I think these works of literature inoculated me against the various ideologies of totalitarianism, and perhaps I was primed to become a classical liberal or libertarian thereafter. One common thread in these works is the relationship between language and power. Of course, this is most developed in Orwell. If you recall, in 1984, the subjects of Big Brother were required, through a process of doublethink and newspeak, to reject obvious and self-evident truths, such as 2 plus 2 equals 4, in favour of false dogma, such as 2 plus 2 equals 5. Here, language is simply a function of state control, and reality is whatever official doctrine dictates. Those who refuse to comply are branded as thought criminals and sent for re-education. I do not think it is hyperbolic to suggest that this has some contemporary relevance. In the culture war in which we are currently engaged, the first battle to win is the language game. This comes prior to all other issues. Perhaps the number one reason that pro-liberty sentiment has been falling in recent years has been the near total dominance of socialists on the linguistic field. As long as they can frame the issues on their terms, they will ultimately prime and anchor the general populace to embrace the fallacious arguments used to oppose free markets that we have seen for the past 200 years now. So today I want to focus on how our adversaries, the enemies of liberty, have succeeded in committing linguistic terrorism and suggest some ways of countering them. The key reason for their success has been their superior tactics, waging warfare with the spoken word and pen. I will focus on just four of these tactics, but there are likely many more. The four tactics are: number one, linguistic inversion; number two, the Mott and Bailey; number three, gaslighting; and number four, the Kafka trap. These methods have been used to bully and corral the defenders of liberty into submission, using nothing but threats and intimidation for the past century. These are all arguments without argument, or, as Thomas Sowell put it in the best treatment of this topic before now, verbal preemption. The basic strategy is to shift the register from logos, that is, reason and evidence, where it is more difficult to make headway, to ethos and pathos, where rhetoric can sway the passions and overcome logical argumentation. I just want to provide a brief guide to know what you're up against. Otherwise, as one well-known former communist put it, it's Godzilla versus Bambi. Linguistic inversion is when words are defined to mean the exact opposite of their everyday meaning. Let us take a phrase like justice. In everyday English, most people take justice to mean something like reciprocal just desserts. This relies on equality under the rule of law. In other words, everyone is subject to the same rules. This is fairness. but modify it with the word social to form the phrase social justice, and we are left with an idea that certain victim groups should get special exemptions or privileges. In other words, the opposite of what most people take to mean justice. Therefore, virtually every social justice policy is unjust and unfair. For example, the McPherson Report's famous call to end colorblind policing, now usually called racially sensitive policing, quite literally means that different ethnic groups must be treated differently by the police. How well has that gone? I need only mention grooming gangs in Rotherham to illustrate the point. Then there is affirmative action. In other words, the blatant lowering of entry requirements for certain groups. Despite initial claims that such measures will only be temporary and reams of evidence that it has had deleterious effects wherever it has been tried, the policy persists, especially in American education. Another example of linguistic inversion is, dare I say it, in the language of human rights. It is one thing to say, I have a human right not to be punched in the face by you, but quite another to say that I have a human right for you to give me food, shelter, custom, and so on. Human rights are more properly defined as special privileges conferred upon some persons at the expense of others. Most of what are called human rights are entitlements without obligations. If you are faced with someone playing this game in debates or even in private conversation, I recommend fully spelling out in plain English what they mean every time the phrase is uttered. This may sound pedantic, but it is important both to expose the linguistic concealment involved and to force the person using the term to think. Continuously ask for clarification. For example, if someone ever uses the phrase consumerism, I will always ask them, do you mean individuals buying products that they want at affordable price points? Linguistic inversion is an effective tactic for the enemies of liberty because it puts opponents into a kind of Alice in Wonderland state where up is down and black is white. It is a near constant struggle against the obfuscation and absurdity, as demonstrated in a recent debate watched by millions of people between the almost comically nonsensical Slavoj Žižek and Jordan B. Peterson. Despite being quite wise to these games, Peterson still palpably struggled against such organized chaos. His opponent did not even try to be coherent or consistent. Given that most people in most places would not support the policies of the enemies of liberty if they were stripped of the emotive and concealed terms in which they are usually packaged, they rely on a second technique, a form of hoodwinking, which we can call the Mott and Bailey. This essentially relies on the gap between the everyday meaning of the word, let us say justice, and the more esoteric meaning, as in social justice. The first is the stronger position, the Mott. The second is the weaker position, the Bailey. Nobody is going to come out and say that they are against justice. Everyone is for justice. That is, all individuals being treated the same under the law. Very few people are for social justice. That is, some groups being treated differently under the law for whatever reason. The intellectuals rely on this gap to gain support for their unsuspecting marks. However, occasionally, a wily opponent may try to point this out to them in a debate. And you will see the intellectual, almost always a creature of cowardice, retreat to the first definition of justice as a kind of cover. Then, later, they quietly shift back to the second definition. Such maneuverings can be seen around the word racism, which in everyday parlance is defined as something like prejudice based on race. But in the esoteric lexicon of the intellectual, it is defined as prejudice plus power. This is a classic Mott and Bailey, which can be witnessed on virtually any broadcast of CNN in the past 3 years, or in the tweets of the Labour MP, David Lammy. However, there can be more difficult examples of the Mott and Bailey to spot. Let us take progress, for example. This one is more subtle. Again, everyone is for progress. Even Edmund Burke was for progress. All but the least sensible of us can agree where progress has been made in technological areas. For example, the combine harvester produces a greater output per unit of input than an ox with a plough. This represents a saving of effort and time we can call progress. Similarly, if you look at the cost in average wages measured in time to produce 1 hour of light, no one would doubt that we have made progress. And this is the motto. However, on social and moral issues, it is not so clear that, let us say, the social policies of Tony Blair and their after effects count as progress. Does anyone really think that the change from the values of Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologica to the right-on values of Tony Blair is progress? Well, they might, but the point is that unlike the development of the light bulb, it is strongly debatable and a matter of some contention. And this is the Bailey. When intellectuals use progress, they are often relying on the gap between development towards an improved or more advanced condition and what they really mean, which is social or political change in a direction that we like. Why do intellectuals play this modern Bailey game to sell their ideas? It is because in virtually every case, they must conceal the fact that they are making an active bid for power and control. If these bids were made plainly, they would be rejected by most people, so they must be concealed in this way. The best way to deal with this is to call it out and force them to defend the Bailey and not the Mott. Gaslighting is a word from the world of psychology. It is a technique of manipulation to achieve power. Here are 11 warning signs. Number 1, they tell blatant lies. Number 2, they deny they ever said something, even though you have proof. Number 3, they use what is near and dear to you as ammunition. Number 4, they wear you down over time. Number 5, their actions do not match their words. Number 6, they throw in positive reinforcement to confuse you. Number 7, they know confusion weakens people. Number 8, they project. Number 9, they try to align people against you. Number 10, they tell you or others that you are crazy. And number 11, they tell you that everyone else is a liar. Now, one might spend a long time on any one of these, but the most prevalent form of gaslighting that I have seen in the media over the past few years has been the way in which they will persistently present an extreme, fringe, and radical view held by a tiny minority of people as being in some way representative of what the vast majority of people think, and by the same token, presenting views that are genuinely representative of the majority of people as being at the extreme fringes of allowable opinion. This is a persistent technique on our very own BBC, and it can be seen across a range of issues, from Brexit to how seriously we should take the views of a 16-year-old from Sweden on climate change. There are several studies which have shown evidence of this. In The Strange Death of Europe, Douglas Murray showed the wide gap between audiences whooping and cheering for mass immigration on Question Time, when opinion polls show that the majority of people consistently oppose it. Using data from the British Social Attitude Survey, David Goodhart suggests that this tendency has gone on for many years. Peter Hitchens recounts an episode from 1967 in which the Rolling Stones were charged for various drug offences and Keith Richards was imprisoned for a year. A poll at the time showed that 56% of the population aged between 21 and 34 thought that the sentence was not harsh enough, while only 12% thought that it was too harsh. Yet it was the view of the 12% that was amplified by the media and indeed the eternally right-on Tory party as normative. It could not be clearer then that, wittingly or otherwise, the intellectuals use state institutions, the media, schools, universities, as vehicles for ideological indoctrination in much the manner described by the Marxist philosopher Louis Althusser, a thinker that virtually all university graduates who later make up the ranks of the intellectuals are expected to read. This also explains the persistent belief among the non-ruling elite that voters must have been tricked or brainwashed somehow into supporting Brexit or Donald Trump. It cannot possibly be that their own ideas are being vocalized by someone with a platform, or that those voters simply agree with what they are hearing. they must be explained away as victims of propaganda. And naturally, this is pure projection on their part, because that is precisely what they need to do in order to gain support. Finally, when all else fails, the enemies of liberty must resort to the Kafka trap. This is a preemptive verbal strike at their opponent, designed, as ever, to avoid discussing the issues at hand. The Kafka trap involves a serious smear of some kind, usually accompanied by a label and an accusation: racist, sexist, homophobic, far right, and so on. Structurally, it is identical to the accusation faced by John Proctor in The Crucible. He is accused of consorting with the devil by Judge Danforth, who is essentially a witchfinder general. It is a trap, because no direct answer to the accusation will do. If you deny it, it is affirmation that you did indeed consort with the devil and must be burned at the stake accordingly. In fact, the more you deny it, the further you appear to be guilty. If you affirm it, let us say with a confession and an apology, then you did indeed consort with the devil and must be burned at the stake accordingly. There is no way out of this if you give the accuser moral authority. The technique is used to move the argument from the arena of logos, that is reason and logic, where intellectuals are, despite their reputation, usually very weak, to ethos, that is the moral character of the opponent. Many writers from the past, such as Shakespeare, for example, would have instantly recognized these moves. That is because they were trained in rhetoric as part of their education. They could tell logos, ethos, and pathos apart. However, as far as I can see, our state education system, despite repeated claims to teach critical thinking, does not teach logic or argumentation at any point. I suppose that is progress for you. And so people are just as susceptible to it as are the crowds who are swayed by Mark Antony's rhetoric in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. So how must we counter this form of linguistic terrorism? As we have seen repeatedly in recent years, the enemies of liberty pull no punches. They think nothing of destroying lives. There is no limit to how low they will stoop in pursuit of their own careers, which they have the temerity to dress up as an anointed vision. The ends justify any and every means. Therefore, their opponents, who represent the biggest threat to their continued hegemony, must be ritually purged from polite society. There is no way to counter the Kafka trap if you submit to the moral authority of the accusers. The only form of defense here is to deny the moral authority and to go on the attack until we can argue from a position of moral strength, confident, unapologetic, and uncowed. The prospects for liberty in the next decade seem as faint as a flicker of a solitary candle. Now get out.